Hi, hello, and welcome to the Back to the Pavilion podcast, the original podcast that talks to former cricketers about their lives, careers, and experiences since their retirement from playing the game, and how that retirement has affected them. This week's are a major landmark for the podcast as we reached over 5,000 total plays. So thank you to everyone who has listened so far. This is episode 46, and all previous 45 episodes are available to listen to still on all major podcast providers. So if you've missed any episodes, do go back and have a look. They are all absolutely fascinating. Today we talk to a player whose career spanned 14 years, including 280 matches for Middlesex and England under-19s. A solid wicketkeeper and batter who was always good value in fantasy cricket. Since retirement, he's formed his own company, helped raise millions of pounds for charity, and next week sees the release of his first book, Bales and Boardrooms, which, having been lucky enough to read as an advanced copy, is an excellent, excellent read. So please join me as we welcome David Natch back to the Pavilion.
Do you know what? It's always a tough decision because when you play cricket for as long as I played cricket professionally for 16 years, you start to believe that you've got no other life skills and all you can be defined by is a cricketer. You're so in your own bubble. Everything gets done for you. All you've basically got to do is turn up on time and wear the right appropriate kit that you've been told to wear. So if you're getting that wrong, you've got no chance in life going forward anyway, which I regularly got wrong, to be honest. So it was a bit of a worry. So, look, when you've got your friends, do something that you love, albeit I wasn't loving it at the time. And it's a big, scary, wide world out there. We're having no real skills or no real CV to go into. So for me, it was a massive decision. I had another year on my contract, but I was really not loving it at all anymore. And it was getting me down. I was anxious. I was fearing failure. I was feigning injury not to play. So basically, I was letting my teammates down and letting my club down. So I had no real options. So one day I played in a charity game with Sean Newdow and a few of the guys. Hated it. Normally I love the charity games and the giving back. And I just came back to the missus, got all upset and just said, "That's it, I'm done." And the missus was brilliant. She said, "Look, we back you all the way, you know. You do what is right for you." And next, spoke to the club, went in and saw them the next day. They were absolutely brilliant. They just said Vinnie Codrington was great. Gus Fraser, etc., was absolutely amazing. Just said, "Yeah, look, just come in, stay till the end of the season, be around the lads, don't play, but just, you know, be in the changing room and for the last two or three months of the season, just, you know, run the drinks on and give to the lads as much as you can in the change room." And that was amazing. It was a great way to sort of go out almost, you know, around your friends, knowing that you've got another couple of months to enjoy their company.
I mean, you've got a book coming out in a week or so. You're talking that about the moment you knew your time was up. Was it that clear for you?
Yeah, it was very, very clear. If you're not enjoying something, particularly when you're gifted an amazing opportunity, like I was gifted to be a professional cricketer and play for the club that you love and you've always supported and your parents have always supported and your family have always supported at the best ground in the world, Lords. If you're not enjoying it and you're suffering mentally and physically through that, then you know it's the right time.
You talk about that, like that suffering. When you retired, what kind of impact did that retirement have on you? Was it a weight lifted off your shoulders or was it a "Christ, what do I do now" kind of feeling?
It was a weight lifted off my shoulders initially. And then because the club was so good to me, it basically gave me two or three months to actually think, "Christ, you know, what's my next play?" I was still getting paid. I was very, very lucky. I had a testimonial year 2 years previously in 2007. So I had a little bit of money in the bank, but, you know, it wasn't like the family weren't going to be able to eat 2 months later or anything like that. So I was lucky. Don't get me wrong. I was very, very lucky. But I'd always been entrepreneurial. In the winters, I'd run Nash Cricket, which was a coaching business. I'd taken people away to Australia. So I'd always been fairly entrepreneurial as well. So I just felt that it was the right time for me to take a step back, do something else. But then when I was out the game, you know, 3-4 months later, you know, you miss all your mates day to day, and you actually start thinking, Christ, you know, you look at a CV that is no CV because it's a cricketing CV. I went to college, straight from college, played cricket, did nothing else. So apart from, you know, my own small little businesses in the winter. So really, I had no CV. I had no real qualifications. I was mid-30s and I was out in the real world. And then it starts to dawn on you, Christ, you know, what am I going to do next? Is someone going to give me an opportunity, or am I going to have to make it work myself?
You mentioned that you retired with a year left on your contract and you had a testimonial 2 years before you retired. That last contract that you signed with Middlesex is quite unusual, wasn't it? Was that part of you planning to for the end?
I think that contract with Middlesex, looking back on it now, that negotiation on that contract that I did actually has proved to me that I was far better businessman than I was a cricketer. Because I basically was getting the feeling that I was being pushed out. I was on a decent amount of money at the club, one of the higher earners because I'd been there so long and a cap player for so many years, et cetera, et cetera. And there was a young guy coming through called Ben Scott, who was a brilliant keeper. He wasn't a great batsman, but he was an amazing keeper. And he could have turned into a really good batsman. You know, for me, he's probably one of the best keepers in the country. Mm-hmm. Standing up, I think he was the best. Amazing hands, brilliant keeper. And, you know, he'd just come to the club on small money. So I could feel that the club were looking to shave a bit off the wage bill. And I felt that I was going to be the one that was going to fall foul to the sword. And I went to the club and said, look, I was very honest and said, I feel that this is what's going to happen. I don't want it to happen. So I've been at this club since an under nine, love this club to pieces. How about I take a £12,000 pay cut? But in the winters, I then work in your marketing department and your sponsorship department to try and bring in sponsors in that will hopefully on a commission that will hopefully get me a little bit of that £12,000 back, give me some kind of experience in the business world. And also then if you give me a benefit year in 3 years, I'll have decent contacts from that. And I went to them and said, you know, give me a new 3-year contract. I'll take 12 grand off my salary. And they went, we've never heard this before, Nashi. No one's ever said this before, but we'll take it to committee. And took it to the committee, and the committee said, yeah, let's go with it. So that's what happened. And I think it was definitely the best deal I've ever done in my life, because without that, doing that deal, I wouldn't be where I am today.
What did you take from those few years into your life after cricket? From that last contract, that working in the marketing department and the sponsorship department, what skills did you learn there that you've taken into your business now?
People. You know, I've not been very good at much in my life. I'm pretty useless at pretty much everything, but one thing I'm quite good at is people. I'm very honest, straight guy. I never let anyone down. You know, I'm a bit of a pleaser. I think that's where a lot of like my mental health issues have surfaced. I never want to let anyone down, and I always want people to have fun in my company. And people generally like me, and I think people buy from people that they trust and they like. And that was something I massively learned. I learned that you have to ask. You know, too many of us, we don't ask. We don't ask for the deal. If you don't ask, you don't get, full stop. So you just got to do it in the right way. But I learned that. It's all about people. I created an amazing benefit committee from, you know, a lot of high profile people in the city that I was fortunate enough to coach their kids for many years. And then, you know, I gave to them. And they wanted to give back to me. That was why my testimonial year was such a success.
You'd done that element of, you know, planning and preparation for life after cricket. Had you done anything else? Did you know what you were going to do when you finished?
Absolutely no clue whatsoever. No clue. I was lucky enough to go to Malvern College and do my A-levels there. So I had a decent network of people. I loved socialising. So all I literally did was I just attended events and sporting functions, etc., or played in cricket days or whatever I was asked to play in, and met people. And I got lucky. I met a guy called Tim Chadwick, who was the FD at Wasserman Media Group, who's a lovely guy. And he just said, Nashi, you know, he heard my story, sort of chatting to him on the day we played in a cricket game at Lord's charity day. And he just said, you know, what are you doing now? Took him through it. And he just said, look, well, at Wasserman Media Group, they're a massive global sports agency. We're looking to set up a cricket division, and I think you'd be the man for it. And he introduced me to the CEO, Sam Rush, went and had an interview, which is my only first interview of my life properly. I don't think I've ever actually had an interview today. Like, that was my only job. So I did that job for a year. I was absolutely useless at it. I wasn't able to take any money off the players because I know what the players got paid, and, you know, I felt it really wrong. So I made the business absolutely no money whatsoever. But it was really, really weird, because I even went to Sam, like, after 6 months and said, look, Sam, I'm not very good at this. This is not me. I'm not going to be able to make you any money, because I just feel too bad about taking money off these guys. And he said, oh, no worries, Nashi. You know, keep doing what you're doing. I'll tell you what we'll do. We'll just lessen your days down and just come in a couple of days a month and we'll still pay you. And I'm like, well, really? He said, yeah, you're just great fun around the office and people like having you around. And I'm like, oh, sounds a good job to me. So I was doing that basically while I then basically had an idea and basically went on my own and set up my own business. So Sam really backed me. And yeah, I basically had to be the class clown that turned up and just was upbeat with everyone, go and have a cup of coffee with everyone, see how they are. And I did that for 6 months until Sam sort of said, right, that's about all we can do now. Now we need to move on. And I just, went on my own merry way.
I think every business should employ that person to, you know, we're just 2 days a week, just come in and cheer people up. I think every business should have one.
I was before my day, because I actually called myself. I said to Sam and Tim, I suppose I'm your head of people. But it was that. And, you know, I'd always come in on like a Thursday or a Friday when there would be team drinks. And then I'd go out with the team. I'd just try and put a smile on people's faces, really. And, it didn't feel like I was really, I certainly wasn't doing the job I was meant to be doing when I first started. But it did feel quite sort of shallow that was my gig. But I did it for 6 months and actually quite enjoyed it. And it was a real opportunity. It helped me, like, you know, pay the bills, et cetera, whilst I set up my own thing. So, yeah, massive debt of thanks to Sam Rush and Tim Chadwick.
You talked there about setting up your own thing, which you've done and is, you know, a really successful business. What is your business now? What is D&G all about?
We basically raise money. We work with corporates that raises money for their charity partners and all their foundations. And we've been absolutely blessed that we've had great clients, and we still have great clients, likes of ASOS, Argos, Holland & Barrett, Bidfood, Brakes, Rolls-Royce. And we're able to give back. We've raised over 20 million for charity since we started our business. It was an idea out of a spare bedroom idea I had, and myself and my brother started out of a spare bedroom at my mum and dad's house. So it's a great story, but it's amazing for us, because the purpose we have every day to get out of bed and work when we're doing this for good causes, and we're able to do, you know, we've set up a thing called D&G Smiles in our business, where every month we support something that the business wants to support. So we support a young girl on all her studies that's been through a really, really tough time in Sri Lanka. A local guy got stabbed, so I got in touch with him and said, what would your wish be, what would you like to do? He said, I'm an absolutely huge Villa fan, I'd like to go to the Carling Cup final. Or so we took him to that. Every month we're able to do stuff like that, which makes a difference and puts a smile on people's faces, hence D&G Smiles.
That's amazing. I mean, you mentioned there about giving something back. How important is that to you within your business to be able to give something back?
It's everything. That's why we set up the business, and that is our motto and our strap line: enjoy giving something back.
Did you think, I know when you did your benefit year, you donated a lot of that to charity as well. Did that idea sort of ruminate? Did it come from that benefit year?
It did, because I was able to support Shooting Star Chase Children's Hospice, who now I'm an ambassador for since my year. And we've raised over £300,000 for since I started supporting them, which I'm really, really proud of. It's local to me in Hampton. And it's absolutely great. And the feeling of actually giving back and, you know, them making me an ambassador, going around seeing, you know, you're one phone call away. I'm very, very lucky. I've got five amazing daughters, but I'm one phone call away from my absolute nightmare and my well-being turned upside down. So able to support the people that are going through these shocking times and just make a small difference. Whether it be, you know, we're paying for the hydrotherapy pool for a year or, you know, a nurse for a family for 6 months or whatever, makes a massive difference.
You've written a book about your life in cricket and coming out of cricket and going into business. How did the book come about? Was it always something that was going to be on your horizon to do?
Not at all. It's actually just sitting down in the office with a good friend of mine, Gary Lace, who ran a number of big advertising agencies, and Simon Pavitt, one of my best friends from school, who was basically working as a consultant in our business in our consultancy division around all our CSR, and he just said, we were just having a laugh one day and just talking about stories, and he said, "Oh, Nash, you should write a book," and I went, "Oh God, can you imagine it?" He went, "No, you seriously should. I think it would be an amazing read, and I think people would get a lot from it." And I started thinking about it more, and then I just thought, do you know what? There's so many. I was seeing more and more how people coming out of cricket really struggle, with mental health, you know, with gambling, etc., etc. Just being very, very down from being around your friends to, you know, and being in our small little world a little bit of a somebody, to then having no skills like myself, but not necessarily not being entrepreneurial to be able to set something up themselves. So they, you know, they really, really struggle to go out there, can't find a job, you know, and then they're down on their luck. So I was seeing that more and more. So I thought, wouldn't it be a great time now to actually try and help these people and just show them that you don't have to be very, very bright. You can be a short, fat, bald lad like myself from Sunbury with very few skills, and still with determination and a bit of hard graft, you can make something of your life after cricket.
What reaction did you get from friends and family when you said, "I'm going to write a book"?
Most of them said, "Well, make sure it's a colouring book." So, that was a tough one to take. So I wouldn't say I'm the brightest. I did English A level at Malvern College, but I didn't get through it because I got chucked out for plagiarism in my coursework. I just couldn't do it. I was struggling. I was finding it really, really difficult. So I copied a good friend of mine, Laura Jordan's, one of hers. And the teacher said, "Nash, this is plagiarism that you've copied." And I was like, "Yep, I have. I'm not even that clever enough to change the words." And so I got chucked out of my English as well. So I didn't even complete that, which was not great.
You mentioned there about the struggle of coming out of cricket and going into the real world, for want of a better term. What support is there? What support was there for you? And what more do you think needs to be done for cricketers who are coming out of the game?
I think the PCA do a really great job, and they really, really do. They're a great organisation. They're run brilliantly now by a guy called Rob Lynch, who I dealt with a lot of Middlesex when he was the commercial director there. He's absolutely brilliant. He's empathetic. He's commercial. He's driven. I feel that maybe some of the CEOs at the PCA previously have been a little bit uninspiring, if I'm totally honest with you. But I feel now they've got the right man to really drive it forward. But it's a great organisation. But I just feel that maybe there should be more they should do more stuff with players that have basically gone on, who have played cricket, who have then gone on to do well in business, because then the players can sort of identify themselves with them. Whereas, you know, not necessarily, you know, obviously they're doing a lot of educational courses and stuff like that. But I think it's really, really important to bring back ex-players that have gone on to do well in business, and those that haven't, to talk about, you know, their learnings on how they went about it and what the lads can then take from it. Because, you know, just little things like, for me, like, it's sales. This world is all about sales. You know, when I speak to you, write 6 things on your card that I've taken at the end of the evening that will be facts that I can remember about you. So when I then go and speak to you again and ask you a favour, or I have an idea for you that I'm looking to sell into you, I can engage rapport and remember what we were chatting about and stuff like that. And people are more likely to buy from you. Because as we said, it is mainly, it's about people.
I mean, you talk there, you know, and you talk about it in your book as well. I'm very lucky to have read a copy before it's come out. You talk a lot about the links.
Did you stay awake? Did you stay awake throughout, or was it putting you to sleep at night?
It was not. It wasn't putting me to sleep at all. I mean, I've got a keen interest in sport. I've got a keen interest. I always, before I stopped being a teacher, I was a business studies teacher. So I found it really, and, you know, my job now, I think a lot about leadership as well. So actually for me, it was, I read it in, I think, 2 sittings. And the only reason I didn't read it in 1 sitting is because I've got 2 kids. And they can always tell when I'm trying to read something. I'm sure, you know, if ever I lose them, I'm just going to pick up a book because they appear. But I found it really, really interesting. And you talk about the links between sport and business. Why do you think sportsmen in general do so well in business?
Do they do well in business? That's an interesting fact. Do they?
I think if you've got someone who was starting from a similar position of you, having come out of another industry and yourself, I think that you would make more of a success of what you've done than someone who hadn't been a professional sportsman.
I think so. That's really interesting. I think my views on that is that they certainly have all the tools to be able to make it work. Because if you've played as long as I've played, you've made a lot of friendships, a lot of relationships, you've met a lot of sponsors. And I think you've got a lot of life learnings, because also the fact that you have to turn up on time. You can't get your clothing wrong. You know, obviously you're letting your mates down. You've got a will. You've got a will to win, and succeed, and in you that you have to have to be a successful professional sportsman. And I'm not saying I was a successful one. So I was actually I should have done better, and I probably didn't have enough of that in me. But with the purpose I've now got today, to get out of bed every day and support these good causes and make a difference, it's really really. It's good for me. But no, it's a really, really interesting one. It's a really interesting one, the sportsman thing. It's just about confidence. You know, those guys, if they want to go out and make it work and they run their own businesses, they've got all the tools to succeed. It's just, you've got to have the confidence. You've got to have an idea, and then you've got to have the confidence. And basically you've just got to join all the dots of getting the people around you and the right people around you to make it work. I remember Don McCarthy, the House of Fraser, John King, gave us our first opportunity in business when I went up to him just at an event that he was at while he was out eating his lamb shank. I said to him, "Hi, John, David Nash. I'm a rubbish ex-cricketer at Middlesex. I think I've got a great idea for your CSR. Someone gave you your opportunity. Can you please give me mine?" Of which he said, "Tell me more." Told him more about it. He says, "Come and see me on Tuesday morning, 9 o'clock at Baker Street head office." Went to see him. He said, "I love this. It's a great idea. We're going to give you an opportunity." To which I got to know Don McCarthy, the chairman of House of Fraser, really, really well. And after we delivered their first event, he thought it was absolutely brilliant. I went up to see him to just ask his advice about scaling the business, et cetera, et cetera. To which he said to me, "Nashie, you just got to keep it very, very simple. Go with 3 things. always go with your gut feel, get great people around you, and make sure you whack your best suit on when you see your bank manager.
What kind of events do you run then? What is it? Are you led by the company, or do you, is creative control yours?
We're led by the company of what they want to run. But we'll obviously give our ideas of what works in our experience, but generally it's what the company feel is the best fit for their brand.
Is it sort of golf days, dinners, those kinds of things?
Yeah, gala dinners, sports days, quizzes, whatever the business feel is the best fit for their brand.
We mentioned there about that will to win. Is that the key thing that, you know, if you were going to pick the transferable skills from the cricket field to the business field, is that will to win the key one to take with you?
No, I think the people, leadership and people is the key one for me. Because look, business is all generally, particularly my business is all about sales. It's all about people and creating a culture. And the businesses that are going to thrive are the ones that have a good culture.
So I'd love for you to come and talk to the people that employ me, because we try and set ourselves as a cultural change business within education and healthcare. It's, having read your book, it really spoke to me. And in there, you talk a lot about leadership. What do you think makes a really good leader?
Look, I don't actually think I'm a really, really good leader, because I've read no textbooks or anything like that. I always do it. I've done everything by my gut feel. All I try and do is I'm very empathetic with people, and I like to have an open changing room. Like, my door's always open to anyone that should anyone need me. Even people that have left the businesses, I go out of my way to try and then help them. In whether it be find a new job or contacts, etc., because I just want everyone to win. I want everyone to be happy and everyone to smile. And I don't think it's that hard to just be a good bloke or a good person, to be totally honest with you.
Who was the best leader that you played under?
Strauss. Absolutely amazing, because he was that guy, very empathetic. But also he understood it and knew if he had to give you a bit of a kick up the backside, he'd certainly do that. But also he'd be empathetic and understand you as a person if you were slightly down or he needed to put a shoulder around you, arm around you. He had a good take on how you were feeling as a person and what you needed to be at your best.
Is there any leaders that you ever look back on and go, I'm never going to be like that?
Oh, God. Yeah. Yeah. I'm not going to name names, but there was a few of them.
The do as I say, not as I do type is if you're anything massive. Like me.
Massive. And that's, one thing that you would do is like people like Graham Gooch that were coach on an England A tour that I went on, you'd want to run through brick walls for Gucci, because he was like 45, 50 years old at the time or whatever he was. And he was out there doing all the training with us, every day. And, you want to run through brick walls for people like that. If that was where Strauss was so good as well. He wouldn't ask you to do anything he wouldn't do himself. And that's as good. That's good enough for me. It's all about actions.
You talk in your book about mental health in sport and your own battles with mental health. What do you think needs to be done more to support cricketers with their mental health in and out of the game?
I think cricket is really, really trying hard. I don't know what more it can do. I know that they're really, really trying hard. PCA are doing all they can, supporting so many players that are going through tough times. All you can do, which is, I think, has been brilliant from the likes of Truscothick, Trott, Freddie, those sort of guys that have been through some really, really tough times in cricket. And you got to be able to talk about it. It's not a taboo subject anymore. People, it's not weakness. It's not seen as weakness anymore. When I played, it would be seen as weakness. So couldn't say anything. But now, you know, it's very prevalent. And for me, being able to share and go to, you know, men's health groups and stuff like that, being able to share was a real big thing for me, actually sort of understanding, hearing other people's stories, finding out I wasn't alone. It wasn't just me and I wasn't losing the plot. As you know, in the old days, that's what you would have probably thought. People have thought, oh, he's, you know, lock him up in a straitjacket, he's losing the plot. But it's very, very prevalent, and it's part of society, and we've all got to find a way to help each other to get through.
Is there anything from your on-field career that you still really miss or did miss?
Just the banter, the day-to-day banter with the guys. You know, let's be totally honest. When it's like being in a family environment, you know, you could have a row with somebody. I could have a row with one of my teammates and a massive disagreement, and then 5 minutes later, we're best of pals having a beer in the tavern. Whereas in today's society, you know, you can't necessarily do that. You know, you've got to pick what you say very, very carefully, and you can't always be as yourself as you can in a sporting environment.
A lot of people I've talked to have spoken about that, missing the competitive edge or missing the feedback. Is with your business that making money, giving something back, does that replace that kind of, does the profit and loss replace that instant feedback and that competitiveness to make more money?
Well, we've got it's all about purpose now, day to day for me. So I'm able to do something I love and I'm giving back. And I'm making a difference. So it's all about having a sense of purpose in your life. If you have purpose in your life, I think people are generally happy and content. If you feel that there's no real purpose, then you need to find one.
I mean, you mentioned earlier, I mean, going way back, you mentioned about coaching. Do you still, you know, coach anyone or do anything like that?
Only the little kids, only kids and stuff at my local club that I'll go over and do some sessions, or mates, kids that want sessions and stuff like that. Or might be I'll do some coaching with Strousey for a charity day or something like that. But no, I don't see coaching being something that, particularly in the adult games, not something that I really love. It wouldn't be something that would interest me, to be totally honest with you. But I think I like cricket and I like, you know, the lads around cricket, but watching cricket all day, every day, I think I'd get a bit bored.
You meant in your book, I picked up that you actually coached a team at the Jewish Olympics.
I did, yeah.
How did that come about? And did you win a medal? Was it a great experience?
So my good friend, Hilton Nathanson, a guy who works in the city, great guy, was a massive supporter of the Maccabi Games. And he just asked me and said, look, Nashi, we want to take it all a bit more seriously on the cricket side to try and get GB a medal. Would you mind coaching? So basically I did a year before we put the team together, et cetera, et cetera. We gave ourselves the best opportunity and we did well. We won a bronze medal. We probably should have done better. But we lost in a fiercely contested game against South Africa, which was a really, really tight one. We lost the key moments, but we'd never won a medal before, so bronze was fair. But I felt that we had the ability to maybe do a bit better than that. But great fun, great learning, seeing what you know, being able to go to Jerusalem and Tel Aviv, Yad Vashem, and just see what, you know, people went through many years ago was unbelievable. And they made me feel really part of the team, you know, and I was sort of an honorary Jewishman, which was great. And I loved every minute of my time in their company, and they were just great people. And that was something that I absolutely loved doing. I was blessed.
You talk about, is that, you know, a lot of people talk about, you know, when you're playing, you have highlights on the field. Do you have highlights from your career off the field as well? Would that be one of them?
That's definitely a highlight for me. Obviously, touring the world, different cultures, playing with and against many, 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 many top people, friendships, relationships, memories, you know, being at Stanford tournament, going on England tours to Zimbabwe, Pakistan, England of 19s, England of 15 to South Africa, playing at Newlands as an England of 15, England A tour to Sri Lanka and Kenya. You know, places you wouldn't necessarily go to and wouldn't get involved in the cultures. And when you're on a cricket tour, you're there for 6 to 8 weeks. You know, Pakistan, England 19 tour, you're there for six weeks over Christmas. It's an under 19, you know, great team. Harmison, Tudor, myself, Freddie, David Sales, Gareth Batty. You know, great friendships made, and, you know, times that we beat Pakistan under 19s, Razak, Imran Tahir, etc., in their own conditions as an under 19. We beat them 1-0 in the test matches, 2-1 in the one dayers, and, you know, playing in front of massive crowds. You know, that was a great time.
Actually, sort of on the field, do you have those games that still live in your memory, you know, scoring hundreds or taking loads of catches, or have they just kind of gone now?
But no, they're still there. But if I'm totally honest, we Middlesex as a team, we were in a team transition when I came into the Middlesex side. When I first got there, and, you know, there was Gatting, Haynes, Rampakash, you know, all the legends, John Carr, Fraser, Tufnell, etc., legends of the game. We had an amazing team. But as we went through transition, I think we were better on paper than we were on grass. Put it that way. I don't think we necessarily we didn't fulfil our potential in truth. So that was a very disappointing thing for me. And I do look back with regret on that. But, you know, to be able to, you know, that get hundreds. I remember thinking, you know, got 100 at Lords with Langer as a 19-year-old, batting with Langer. I was on a pair, naught first innings. Caddick got me out. Came in, Shah just bagged him. He just bagged a pair. He's walking through the long room and he smiled at me and said, "Your turn now, bud." And I'm walking out the bat thinking, I'm just not going to get a run here. They've got Caddick, Mushtaq, Ahmed, etc. I was like, I've got no chance. And I put on 230 with Langer, got 114. And, you know, it was great times, brilliant times.
To mention O.A. Shah there, how good a batsman was he?
O.A. Shah should have played 150 test matches. He was unbelievable. He was just on another level, but Oase didn't necessarily fit that culture mold. He'd do it his own way, and he wasn't someone for authority. You know, he didn't necessarily always give in to that team ethic. But he was an amazing. He's still a great friend of mine. He's an amazing loyal friend, but someone like Duncan Fletcher, etc., wouldn't necessarily take to Shah doing things his own way and being his own person. He wasn't a brown nose, you know, he didn't suck up to people. He did it his own way, and that, where the management that were around then, that didn't work.
I always try and find, Nashi, whenever I interview anyone, something that they did as a, you know, a unique thing in their career. And I genuinely couldn't find something for you. But I, as with all wicket keepers, I always look at when you took the gloves off and actually bowled a little bit. You took 2 wickets in your career. Do you remember them? Who were they?
I do very well. So the first wicket, we were bowling at Chelmsford in the days where you had to give people quick runs for a declaration. I was bowling, and Mark Eilot, the left armer who played for England, Ramble, he cut a short drag down ball of mine straight to point, where Shah gobbled up a great catch. And then the second one was Murray Goodwin, who smashed me everywhere, again giving them runs for declaration. And Owen Morgan was keeping, and I just ripped a leg spinner out of nowhere. It was a beauty. It landed perfectly. It turned, he got 140, and it turned past his outside edge, and Morgan took the stumping.
It's that interesting.
Good old English Irishman Owen Morgan, top lad.
Did you see? I mean, going back to thinking about leadership, you know, he's quite rightly, I think, at the moment being talked about as potentially being one of England's greatest ever captains. Did you see that potential in him when he was a young lad at Middlesex when you were playing with him?
Totally. He's so focused, Owen. And one thing that Owen will do, I think, where he's brilliant, and the players will always want to play with him. He keeps things light and bright. He backs the players, you know, he'll pick the people he feels that should be the players that play, and he will back them to the hilt. And he will always be about expressing yourself and having fun, both on and off the field. And if you've got a captain like that, that, you know, trusts in you, then I don't think, you know, you're going to be able to play at your best, and you'll be able to play at your freest, aren't you? Because when you're free playing cricket, that's when you're definitely going to do your best.
Do you ever look back now and think, if you knew what you knew now when you were playing, you'd have done better?
Oh God, unbelievably. Unbelievably. And if I hadn't have listened to some of the coaches who like pigeonhole you and say, oh, don't play this shot, don't play that shot, you're a nudger and nerdler, you know, yeah, totally. But it's too late now. And it was up to me then to actually say, no, I'm going to do it my way and change the philosophy. But unfortunately, I didn't. And and I look back on that with a little bit of regret, that I wish I'd had A, a bit more fun, and B, been a bit more expansive in the way I played the game.
Do you still play now at all? Do you club cricket?
I play a few charity games and stuff like that, and the odd game for Sunbury, but I played the year before last, and when they were really needing me, and I hadn't picked up a bat in 3 years. And I played 2 league games and got 0-1. And then I just realised, Christ almighty, you can't just turn up on a Saturday after 3 years and pick a bat up, and, you know, you're going to make a fool of yourself. And that I certainly did.
I have an obsession with squad numbers, Nashi. And for whatever, in my head, yeah, my head, I don't know. In my head, there's always a big story around them. Like I've always worn number 19 because the first major football tournament I remember was Italia 90. Gazza wore number 19, and so from that point, no matter what the sport, I've always wanted to wear 19. So in my head, everyone who puts the squad number on the back, there's some big story around it. It's got some significance to it. You wore number 10 for Middlesex. Was there any significance around that, or were you just given it?
I don't actually know. I think I can't actually remember. I think they just asked, and I don't know why I wanted 10. Was Michael Owen number 10? I don't actually even remember why I went 10. I just think I like the number 10. And you feel that 10's a bit of a big player, don't you, in your number 10 shirt in a football team. So I think I just thought, oh, and it looks quite good, the number 10, doesn't it? So I just thought, Christ, I'll have number 10. Weird, really. Weird. That's a different one, that. You definitely has the fascination. Yeah. God, you might have to have a little look at yourself there, buddy.
I do on a regular basis, honestly. And it's like, when everyone I talk to, I ask, and it's kind of, some people go, no, just happened to be given it. And then others go, oh, no, I really wanted this number. You're like, that's what I want. That's the stories that I'm looking for. But the amount of people who go, no, what number did I wear? I can't even remember. That shatters my dreams about the you know, the significance of those numbers.
Sorry, mate. I might have to change it then. So what should be, if I get asked that question again, what should I say? Who was number 10? Was Maradona 10?
Maradona wore 10. There you go. You could have walked. Yeah, you could always want to be Maradona, or...
There you go. I don't know if I want to be Maradona now.
Lineker?
Really,
Lineker wore 10, didn't he?
Oh, I definitely don't want to be Lineker. let me have a think about that one. I'll have to do some research.
Do it, you know, yeah, go back. Do it sort of retrospectively.
Kerry Dixon, what number was Kerry?
Not a clue.
What a clue. What a player. What a player he was, Kerry Dixon. I loved Kerry Dixon. If he was 10, I definitely wanted to be 10.
Well, there you go. Are you a Chelsea fan? Is that?
Chelsea and Brentford, we are massive. So my dad's massive Chelsea. I was Chelsea as a kid. And then I basically, in the last sort of 15, 20 years, been going to Brentford a lot with my kids because they're local. And, you know, I think the club's an amazing club. And so we're Bees fans as well. So big year. Hopefully the Bees go up this year.
Yeah.
We're season ticket holders now. We go every week. Went to a lot of the away games last year as well, which was amazing. And brilliantly run club. Great, you know, very well led by John Varney and the chairman, Matthew Benham, who both are huge Brentford fans, which is absolutely brilliant. And that's why culturally they certainly get it right. Like Middlesex, they get it culturally right.
Do you have any involvement there, or is it just I'm just a fan? You offered your services, or
no involvement. We do some work for them on their CSR at Brentford, on their events. But brilliant to work with, just a great club, and no other supporter in the country wouldn't want Brentford to do well.
I always ask about memorabilia as well. Do you have memorabilia from your playing days up around the house or in the office, or is it given away or hidden away? Anything like that?
Well, I've actually just moved into a new house, and I've got a load of sort of shirts I've found in a like little in one of the boxes, like shirts and a few caps and all that sort of stuff. And it's actually really good reminiscing for it a few months ago when I moved in. So, yeah, but I'm not one for really putting stuff like that up. But I might maybe put my cap up somewhere or something like that.
What advice would you give to a young player starting out on their career now?
Good question. Definitely enjoy it. Have fun. Just express yourself. Don't worry. Don't fear failure. And just basically just back yourself massively. Do it. Just do it your way. It's just easier to do it your way.
And what about someone who's coming to the end of their career, maybe mid to late 30s, last couple of years of the contract? What advice would you give to them?
If you haven't networked, network very hard. Don't stand around at corporate or the sponsors' events chatting to your teammates. Get out there chatting to other people. Cricket is a very closed shop. It's a very small world. There's a big world outside of cricket, and but you just got to be very proactive, very positive, and make it happen.
And what about, and I don't ask this very often, but, you know, for someone who's set up their own business and done it so successfully, what advice would you give to someone who was just starting out in the world of business?
Again, network. Basically, look through your book of all people that you've helped over the years that you might be able to ask for a favour back from, that might be able to set you up, whether it be getting cash or opportunities into their world, so you can network, introductions.
And just two more quick. What would you say was the secret to a happy retirement from playing cricket?
Purpose. If you've got a purpose to get out of bed.
And then last one, it's like the job interview question. What's David Nash and D&G doing in 5 years' time?
Very good question, that. Well, hopefully we're doing more of the same. Helping families, helping charities, helping organisations be the best that they can be in the CSR space. And I just hope that we're still supporting our staff as we do, and enjoying our lives and making sure that we have a purpose to get up every day and be the best that we can be. I just say three things to my kids. Treat people as you want to be treated yourself. Enjoy your life and be the best you can be every day.
Regular listeners will know that I end every podcast with a message: take care of yourselves and others, be kind. I don't think anyone can deny that with Nash's business post-playing, he does that. He takes care of himself and his family. He takes care of others with the money that he's raised. Millions of pounds that his business has raised for charity should be applauded, as should his new book. It really is an excellent read. It's not your average sports book. It's an excellent mixture of sport, cricket, leadership and business. It's out on the 22nd of March, but available to pre-order now from www.balesandboardrooms.com. It really is a fantastic read, and I do please beg you to get your hands on a copy. Trust me, you won't be disappointed. Next time on the Back to the Pavilion podcast, we travel to Worcester to meet a player who represented both the Pears and the Bears, until he was released by the former in 2015. Since then, he's followed his passion in ICT to forge a career which has seen him work on many, many IT projects. So join me next time as we welcome Shaq Chowdhury back to the Pavilion. That's all from me today, so do be kind. Take care of yourselves and others. Bye-bye for now.